There we go. Lovely. So, Tommy Chong, welcome along. Thanks very much for taking time out of your day and coming to chat with me on Martin's World podcast. Tommy, you've been an inspiration to myself over the years. When I used to deliver pizza, when I used to finish up after work, we used to park up at the end of my mum and dad's road and flip out a DVD player in the car, myself and a friend, and we used to watch your movies.
good one.
So, Manny, a very well-spent evening in a hotbox Toyota Starlet watching Cheech and Chong.
Well, we do what we can do whenever we can do it. That's
well, I never thought I would find myself, you know, all these years later talking to you. So, Tommy, you've done a lot over the years. You're probably one of the most well-known. You're up there with the likes of Snoop Dogg and Willie Nelson, I would imagine. For me, anyway, you're up there with those guys in terms of the greats in the cannabis world. So it is a real pleasure to get to meet you. I'm starstruck, to say the least.
Well, you know, that's one thing. One of the things that unite us around the world is the love of the cannabis. You know, that magical plant. Well, you know, it's our connection to the divine, mm-hmm. to the most high, to the one connection that we all have. And being united like that with this great plant creates miracles like this.
It does indeed. And can I ask Tommy, when, how, and why did you first get introduced to our friend Mary Jane?
It was through the jazz world. Modern jazz, as they called it back in the old days, modern jazz. It was a jazz club in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And it was the only late night place open. And if you were a musician, which I was, and you carried your instrument into the club, you got in free. And so, and it was the only place to hang out after hours. And there was a bass player, and actually the founder, I found out later, the founder of the jazz club, what was it called? I forget. Well, when the name comes, I'll tell you. Anyway, he came back from Los Angeles with a bag of weed and a Lenny Bruce record. And so he gave me a joint and a Lenny Bruce record. You know, here you go. And it was ordained. You know, it was very... serendipity, you know. Mm-hmm. I never really knew him. He knew of me, but I met him that night, and it was quite an honor. And of course, I put the joint in my pocket, and he lit one of his own. And I just took a couple of tokes. And it just changed my life, you know. I was listening to, they had music playing in the background. And then as soon as I got high, I believe I sat down. I don't remember. But I remember the song. It was Lonely Woman by Ornette Coleman. And that was the song the night that changed my life. Forever. I think the next day or the next, that was the weekend, obviously. And then Monday came along and I went and I quit school immediately. I knew that what I needed to learn was not in the school. It was really out on the streets. And the music that I wanted to play was not being taught anywhere in my neighborhood. And so then I ended up hooking up with a black guy, black football player, and he turned me on to rhythm and blues. I believe I was turned on by that time. Yeah, I was playing blues by that time. And so, yeah, that was part of the whole package, you know. Yeah. If I really wanted to be a blues man, I had to know about pot. and that was it. That changed my life.
So your introduction to the cannabis, I suppose, would have been through music and comedy. But your career started out as a musician. But when did cannabis become so central to your life then through comedy afterwards?
Well, we always used it musically. You know, we always had a we traveled. We got kicked out of Calgary. You know, every important movement in my life was the result of being fired. Being expelled. I got kicked out of Calgary with the band. Of course, we were glad to go, you know. And cannabis really was always a part of it, you know. First of all, it was a big secret with the band. I didn't know that the organ player was also smoking, you know.
Really? Smoking weed. Within the band, you didn't even know.
Because it was so taboo.
Yeah,
it was so taboo. You know that. You know, I mean, all the word out was, you know, made you act crazy and everything. Hmm. It was the jazz people, but the trouble when they said it was a gateway drug. Most of the jazz, if not all of them, they started out with weed, but they ended up with heroin. You know, and it was a heroin that usually stopped stopped the momentum. But a lot of the junkies, you know, a lot of the heroin people, they frowned on the weed, you know. You know, they wasn't of their taking. Although now marijuana is used to help addicts get off get off the hard drugs. But back then, you know, pot was frowned upon by everybody, you know, including the junkies. And so we kept it a secret. And then it wasn't until I met Cheech, really? That I became openly activist. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to become an activist. You know, I had no plans of doing much more than just playing the next gig, you know, playing music. But it was when I went to jail. That's what turned me into an activist, because I had no choice then, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what done it for me as well. At 17, I got stopped and searched, criminalized for having a bit of hash. And that turned me into an activist. So it was much earlier in my life I got activated. I suppose your activation, that only happened in 2003, if memory serves correct, is that right?
Well, that's when I went to jail, yeah.
When you went to jail.
But I mean, even going to jail was a sign of my activism, because the weed thing was going on, but it was the bongs, you know. We had a bong company,
yeah.
And we were kind of skirting around the drug laws, because it was a glass company, you know, and bongs have been on the planet since the beginning of tobacco, or since the beginning of of time. You know, it goes back to China, and I don't know how far back it goes, you know. That's it was the bongs that really got me into the activism, because I got put in jail. I had choices on the way, you know. Mm-hmm. I could have fought the bong thing, and I could have done a lot of things, you know. In fact, they wanted me to denounce the lifestyle and so on. Well, what happened to me, because along with my music career, I started a career in bodybuilding. You know, I was always skinny and kind of weak. Growing up, I spent a year in the hospital when I was, 3-4 years old.
Okay.
And so I never developed you know, properly, you know, like normally. Mm-hmm. And so I was always a kind of a light in the butt, you know, I was a little lightweight. And so when a friend of mine went to jail and he got out, a young kid, you know, we were both 16, I guess. And he came out all buffed, you know, he'd been working out. And he came out and I looked at him, and he had a chest, he had arms, he had shoulders, you know. And I said, what happened? He worked out with weights. But it was funny. He quit. As soon as he got out, he quit weightlifting, you know, and he went back to his old ways.
He played it within a month.
But when I saw the transformation, well, then I started going to the YMCA, you know, just working out in the weight room. By the way, back in the day, the weight room was about the size of a small kitchen, you know, and it was just a handful of weights, and they were like really crude, but there were something. And then we went to Vancouver, and when I got to Vancouver, then I found a real weightlifting weight room, and the weight room in Vancouver, they had a sort of like a tradition. The little guys, the lightweights, stayed upstairs, and you had to be able to bench press or incline press 45 pounds on either side, you know, 245s in order to go down to work downstairs. And so it was like it took me about a year.
It's funny you say that now. I was watching a video earlier today, and you were flashing that tattoo you got off the biker on your arm. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, geez, Tommy's pretty buff. You got a big old arm on you. So yeah. That explains it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. I went, well, as far out as I could. You know, I'm one of those, you know, I'm not a fanatic of anything, you know. Mm-hmm. Except being, you know, being social.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And so I ended up really getting into the weightlifting, the bodybuilding. And in fact, my dream, like a lot of bodybuilders in Vancouver, mm-hmm. was to go down to Gold's Gym, where the big guys worked out. And I did. I managed to do that. When I left Motown, I went right to California, and I lived on the beach. I joined the gym, Gold's Gym, nice. And I worked out right up until Joe Gold passed away. Joe and all my buddies there. I had a good, almost 20 years of working out there, and it was great. What a great life! And because bodybuilding gives you a body,
yeah,
and it gives you good habits. And if you got a body, that means you got a face, you got hair, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Well,
and you got a carriage, you know, you stand up straight, you know, and it answers all the questions you need, you know.
Yeah, definitely can add yours to your life as well if you do it right.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And there's no shortcut. You see, I learned a lot of life lessons with the bodybuilding. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, you can do it, but you have to pay. You have to work. You can't give up. You got to work. Got to work through everything. And it's about pain. You know, no pain, no gain.
Yeah, I know all about that.
Yeah, yeah. And no, so it works.
I do a lot of martial arts myself, mainly Thai boxing. But I'm into a lot of plyometric body weight stuff. I don't like to go after big weights. I don't want to get too buff.
Yeah. Well, they used to tell you at the gym, you know, when you get, you know, like they would say, they didn't want to look like Arnold. And so the gym guys would say, well, when you get there, we'll make you stop. we'll stop you.
Let you know.
before you get that big.
Well, Tommy, can I ask, I'll pick up on something you mentioned earlier. You say you didn't become an activist until you ended up in prison. Would you not have seen your work through Cheech and Chong and that humor, through your comedy, that in itself wasn't a form of activism?
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. But, you know, more so than that, we had a choice, mm-hmm. you know, to do what kind of movie we wanted to make.
Yeah.
Because it was brand new. Neither Cheech or Lou Adler, who ended up directing Up at Smoke, you know, they weren't really interested in making movies. It was me that created that because I got tired of touring, you know. I loved touring when we first started out, but when it became a job, you know, when it became repetitious, mm-hmm. you know, and almost like necessary because you got to pay bills, you better go on tour, you know, I resented that. You know, especially going to Australia. Yeah. You're working in America is fine because you're home, you know. But when we the first time we went to Australia, it was a novelty. Okay, we did it. It was tough mm-hmm. because there's no Mexicans. You see, half our act depended on having Mexicans in the audience, mm-hmm. you know. And that really made us superstars. Well, Australia, there's no Mexicans. And so it was almost, the burden was almost like shifted to me because, you know, Cheech is the Mexican's half, I'm the other half. And it was all about the others. And so I found out that I had to rewrite. You can't go back with the same show. At least I thought we could. You know, people do, but I knew. No, you got people that, especially the guys that book you, you know. And yeah. if you show up there with the same tired, you know, show. Because the show has to be fresh, mm-hmm. you know, to you. You know, and you can always tell when someone's just repeat, you know, going through the motions. And then it's no fun. It's no fun for the audience. It's no fun for the people. And so I felt that three times in Australia was enough, you know. And so then I started writing a movie because I saw the future as a movie. And when Cheech and Lou found out, then he said, "Oh, okay, we're going to do a movie." And I didn't even show him my movie. You know, because Lou had a different idea of what he wanted, and so I just, you know, went their way, and then I wrote a song called "Up in Smoke," and I sang it for Cheech and Lou, and Cheech says that's the title, and so we had the title of the movie. Perfect. And then Cheech and I decided, well, we'll do our two famous characters, you know, and then that's when I decided that I would become, as you say, an activist for not just weed, but for the Chicano community, mm-hmm. you know, the Latino community, because up until then, you know, they were having white guys play Latinos, you know, they were having, and then when they played Latinos, it only showed them with headbands and guns. You know, they were like real
gangbangers.
Yeah, the gangbangers, you know. And so then I wanted to show a Chicano musician, mm-hmm. you know, and Cheech was a singer, you know.
Yeah.
And so he's going to be the singer of the group. And then on the other hand, I always like to deal with opposites, you know. And so I wanted to have the opposite of Cheech, which would be, at the time, I wasn't sure. I knew that Cheech would be poor. This character would be from a wealthy family. Mm-hmm. And then Cheech's cousin, Louis, came up with the whole concept of Anthony Stoner. Anthony was a Jewish kid, a rich Jewish kid, but he was too old to live at home, but he's living at home. Yeah. He was like the world's oldest teenager. And so, and then for characters, when we did our record, Cheech and I used a lot of jazz phrases, you know, and man, calling each other man. See, that comes from a history of back in the day, the jazz musicians, all the black people were called boys at the time. Hey, boy, get over here, boy. Yeah. You know, boy, it was a demeaning attitude saying that no matter how old you were called a boy, mm-hmm. you know? And so the jazz guys, starting with Miles Davis, they used to call each other man. So what's going on, man? Instead of boy, it was man. And so then I thought I'd add that in there. And so, hey, man, hey, man. And so we had a lot of hey, mans in there. And so we never did. Anthony was his an up in smoke. His name was used once. You get Anthony, you get a job by sundown, you know, and that was, it was taught up. We definitely, I definitely had that in mind. And then I wrote most of the, you know, the plot and, you know, the idea of getting a truck made or a car made out of marijuana.
Oh, you know.
Yeah. So that was my idea. And then I wanted to put the cops in there too. Mm-hmm. In fact, I used the name of a real cop that used to bug us in Vancouver.
No, you know,
yeah. Stadenko was a real cop.
He was actually
and he got so famous that they transferred him to Turkey. he got transferred out of Canada to Turkey. And he wasn't a friend of mine. He busted friends of mine. You know, he jacked up my dad one time because there was a pot grower or seller living at the border. And so I had a kind of a vendetta going with Stadenko was his name, Abe Stadenko. Yeah, so so the whole movie Up in Smoke really was a protest against the depiction of Chicanos and the depiction of potheads. You know, I wanted to bring out the humor in it, you know, how funny pot could make you be under all circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, the cop stopping us, you know, getting stoned off the exhaust pipe and then coming and eating the hamburger, the hot dog, you know, those were all incredible anti-drug law protest scenes in the movie. And that really helped make the movie the iconic movie it is today, you know.
Well, it truly is an icon, and it'll definitely stand the test of times, and it has forever it'll hold its place in cannabis culture, that's for sure.
For sure.
My favorite scene in the movie was the whole car scene going down the highway yourself and Cheech, before he ends up with the cops, you know, you keep on knocking, but you can't come in. and the Labrador, that whole scene. Oh, I laughed so hard. Oh, I was in pain. Really did. Oh, in pain. But, I love that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we perfected a lot of those scenes with our act, you know, our live act. And that was the other thing we did too. We made our live act become visual, you know, because we'd done that scene. That's how we started. We started in a club, and it was out of necessity, you know, because we started in Canada, and we never did any Latino jokes at all. Because we never knew that Cheech was a Chicano. You know, it wasn't until Cheech and I became Cheech and Chong that I found out that he was Chicano. And then we never stayed in Vancouver. We came right away. Once we found out we could, you know, the two of us, and we came down to L.A. And when we got to L.A., we found out that very quickly that we had to do some pot jokes, because that was the only thing that everybody related to at the time. Yeah. And so Cheech never did a Chicano character until we came to Canada, I mean, to Los Angeles. And then he started doing that Chicano character. And the minute he said, hey, Red Freak, want to ride, man? that really was the sound of money, because that changed the whole, you could hear the whole club just electrified. You know, they had never heard anything like that or saw anything like that with a real Mexican. Yeah. You know, there's some Bill Dana, there's a bunch of Jewish guys that would play Chicanos and get laughs, you know. And they had all these little cartoon characters, Latinos, you know, Chicanos and that. But it wasn't until Cheech, a real Chicano, said, "Hey, Red Freak, you want to ride, man?" As soon as he said that, man, it was like we just discovered penicillin. Something. It was like, whoa. That was it. And then when that happened, then I knew it was a matter of time that we were going to be conquering the world.
All right. You knew you had a feeling then after that.
Oh, I know. Well, you can, if you're on stage, you can tell, you know, when you hit a nerve. Oh, you know, and that's with hit songs too. You know, when you know, no matter how hard you work on the song, if you don't have the right combination of everything, you know, it'll be, well, like the Grateful Dead music. I just watched a Grateful Dead documentary, and the most amazing thing about the Grateful Dead is that they must have written over 200-300 songs, and not one's memorable. you don't hum one. You can't hum one. You can't even think of one that you go, you know.
Yeah.
Where you get a guy, you get a song like Louie, everybody in the world was singing Louie, you know.
Good. Can I ask, Tommy, actually, on your work then after Cheech and Chong, you got so famous around cannabis. Did traveling ever become a problem? Were you ever targeted? Like, I know with the bong stuff, you did become a target afterwards. Did you ever get targeted traveling? You know, Australia, for example. Did you get like extra extra attention paid to you?
We got the attention, mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. But you know, so many people in the culture were those cops, were those guys. You know, so many people, and so they ignored it unless it was in their face. You know, okay. They totally ignored it, unless you're, you know, transporting tons or something, you know. But yeah, I always got caught with a joint or a pipe or something, you know, and then they would take me in the office and they would, you know, at first try to me, and then, you know, I'd just sit there and look at them and they let me go, you know. We got targeted, but more for our humor. And more for the laughs that we give people, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like I was, you know, trying to make a militant statement with the pot, you know.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, once you do up in smoke and you get people laughing, especially cops, then when you get stopped, you're a hero, you know, even with the cops, you know.
Yeah.
Because they loved the fact that that we made them, you know, visible. Because we took them out of their caricature, you know, where people always had them, you know, being mean and all that shit. And then we had them getting stoned and acting crazy. And so the cops really loved that part, you know.
Yeah, they get to be seen as human too, I suppose.
Well, yeah, you know, people, especially in America now, you know, they like to demonize the cops from watching the press. I'm watching the TV now without sound on, and it's always about you know, cops and shooting people or killing people and all that, you know. Well, I went on a ride along with a cop, because like I said, I was in Gold's Gym, and a lot of the police would train at Gold's Gym, a lot of cops, you know, they're all pretty well bodybuilders, you know, for their job, and so I got to know one cop real high up, Eric Struthers. He was, they were looking at him to head the Homeland Committee thing in Los Angeles, or actually in America. He was a buddy, and he said, "Would you like to go on a ride along?" And so I went on a ride along with cops for one night. Mm-hmm. And I swear to God, man, I've never had so much adrenaline rushes in my life. And mm-hmm. and it was, and the cops told me it was, this is like a normal night. Jeez. But it was crazy. I mean, we stopped these gang guys. They were going 80 miles an hour. I think it was 4 a.m, soaking wet, coming from the beach. Yeah. And they were stopped, but we were backup. We had to come because they had threatened the cops that stopped them, the motorcycle cop or something, with violence. And so we were backup. And these gang guys, they're giving the cops the fingers and all that. And so the cops made them walk home because they impounded the car. And there was a lot of threats exchanged between the cops and these guys. And it was like, you know, I'm going to get my AK and come back and kill all you motherfuckers and, you know, stuff like that, you know. And this is what cops go through every night, yeah, every day.
Definitely, you know, too rewarding a job to do for sure. And it's very,
oh my God, you know. So you can understand why, you know, if you see a black guy reaching for something other, you know, and the guy says, don't reach for your gun, don't reach for your gun. You know, you can understand the fear, you know, because it only takes one bad decision and you're dead.
It is. So, but it's just unfortunate, though, that the color of your skin is a reason to be afraid, you know, for cops. And it's disproportionately there. If it was a white guy, that they're less likely to think he's reaching for a gun than if it was a black person and all of that kind of.
Well, it is and it isn't.
Yeah,
it definitely is for sure that there is danger out there for the cops. Mm-hmm. It's also true that the cops cause a lot of that because they don't like to be scared of cops. No. They don't like to be scared of anybody. And so when they do stop a guy, say that is innocent, you know, a lawyer or whatever, they tend to be mean to the guy because they know he's harmless, you know, he's not going to hurt him. And so they tend to be, you know, because they're scared shitless when they walk up to the guy, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're walking up and they're going to kill him. They're walking up thinking that they're going to get shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so and when they find out that the guy is a doctor, a lawyer, you know, he's not going to hurt him. Well, then they can get shitty, you know, especially if the guy, you know, I know my rights. If the guy starts that, then the cop, because he knows that he's got the freedom to do whatever he wants to do with these guys,
mm-hmm.
You know, and if he's a crooked cop like they had, you know, in the 50s and that, or in like in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's warfare on either side, you know. Well, I understand both. I understand both sides.
Yeah.
But you know, getting back to the question of weed, once the cops recognize who we are, and there's no danger, mm-hmm. then they can be friendly, and then they can, you know, then they can show. They can let down their guard, you know, and Cheech would tell them all the time that his dad is a cop because his dad was a cop, you know, in Los Angeles, in the toughest part of the area. Yeah. And so actually the Cheech and Chong gave us license around the world to do. Hey, I got into Japan. Can you imagine that? Now, Japan is one of the strictest, you know, pot countries in the world. If you even look like you got a T-shirt or something, you know, they will stop you. Or if you look like you, well, I came in there. Now, I'm older. My wife's gorgeous. And she's, you know, she got all the Rolex watches and all this stuff in there. And when you go into any country, here's a tip for people. If you go into any country, if you can, wear the country, the hat or the insignia of that country. And right away you will present this. I'm coming into your country to spend a lot of money. I am a tourist.
Yeah.
You know? And if you act like a tourist, then they'll open the gate. Man, come on in.
Yeah.
But if you come in either looking like a undercover cop or some kind of guy on the run or some gangster or some hippie, you know, they hate hippies because hippies, they don't spend money.
<Want a backup. laughs>
they camp out. In fact, you know, and so I'm coming into Japan with my wife, and I have to put down, you know, that I had a drug bust, which was bongs, but still. So I put it on that thing. And so I get called into the main guy's office. And right away, he looks at me. And I'm quite sure I was there by myself, but I'm quite sure he got a picture of my wife. And I'm wearing a Rolex, and my wife's wearing a Rolex. I'm dressed nice. And so the guy goes, broken English, what drugs? I said, no drugs. I said, it was bongs, water pipes. He goes, aha. He says, okay, here, you lie.
You lie.
If they ask you, you lie. Tell them, no drugs, you lie. And welcome to Japan.
happy days. At least they were okay about the bongs.
Yeah, you lie.
Yeah, the pity that...
Japanese, they sell pipes. You know, they sell smoking pipes. They've been smoking opium since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
They got these beautiful Japanese...
Really intricate pipes.
Pipes, all beautiful. The tiny little...
Yeah.
Opium bowl. It's not tobacco. It's for opium.
Yeah.
Tiny little bowls. You know, I got a collection here somewhere.
Nice. You know? Can I ask? During the raids, when you got raided by the cops, they came at about 5 a.m, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Did you actually really think that you were being punked by Ashton Kutcher, or was that just a joke you were trying to tell?
We weren't sure. We weren't sure. My wife woke me up, bang, bang, bang on the door. It did freak me out. I wasn't scared. I'm never paranoid, you know. I don't know why. I thought, well, usually because I'm usually stoned. You know, it takes me a while to come out of the fog, you know. No, I had no idea. And then when I saw them, they look like trick-or-treaters, you know, like Halloween, you know.
Distressed.
And Halloween apples or, you know, whatever. Trick-or-treat. That's what it felt like because they had their mask on, they had their guns, they had their boots, they had their vests. They had their whole regalia, you know, whole outfit, you know. And I'm standing there in my bikini shorts. They weren't even jockey shorts. They were bikini shorts. And... it was quite a few years ago, so I was quite virile, and I had a little bit of wood, and so I know. and I'm used to walking around in my underwear in my own house, you know.
Yeah.
And so finally, the lead cop told his friend, hey, take him upstairs and get him some clothes, get him dressed, because I was making him all nervous walking around like that. Then when they came in and said, we have a warrant and for, you know, we're going to take your computers. And so that's what they did. They took all the computers in the house and they ruined them, by the way.
Really?
You know, they literally trash them, you know, by taking, you know, looking for stuff. They take everything. What they do, they take everything apart and then they don't want to put it together. So they say it's just trash it. Or they keep it for evidence, you know. Mm-hmm. No, the cops are like criminals, you know. They come in and they anything valuable they grab, you know, call it evidence, whatever, because they're usually dealing with drug dealers and dope dealers, you know. They don't care, take all the money, they, you know, they get a few billion somewhere else anyway, you know, as part of the cost of doing business, you know. And they treated me semi nice, but shitty enough to make me know that I couldn't get be a kind of a smart ass, you know.
And what was going on? You were treating yourself with cannabis for cancer. Is that right? Well, around that time?
No. I was. I never got. I got cancer in jail. I think that's where I got it, picked it up. Yeah. Okay. Because I was totally healthy before I went to jail, and then when I went to jail, I got a bad case of gout, and I got rectal cancer while I was in there.
Over the
because I could, I felt it coming. I felt it. Yeah, I felt there was some, you know, stuff going on with my junk. You know, there's something funny going on.
Yeah.
And I got that. And the jail I was in was or is built over a toxic waste dump. It was the first site of the first oil well. See, but when they discovered oil, they had no way of containing it. So they would dig these big ponds. And then, of course, the land would become useless. Mm-hmm. And so they built a prison over it. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the prison, including myself, and ended up with cancer. You know, a lot of the guards and that, they died early from cancer.
Into the water.
Yeah, everybody that I was in there with, except for exceptions of a few of the inmates, are gone. They're dead.
No way.
Yeah. They had a thing called Valley Fever there. Jeez. When I was in jail. And if the wind got too heavy, they made everybody come inside. Because there's that crap in the dirt that would kill you, or you get cancer.
Like your non-crime really bongs, but like you have the Moore Act, you know, at the moment going through the U.S. state over. Do you think that there's the provisions in the Moore Act go fair enough? Like considering all that you've been through as a prisoner now for your crime of selling drug paraphernalia, bongs. Like, is there anything they can put into that will truly even repay you as a prisoner or as a victim of that prohibition?
I'm not sure. I have no idea. You know, I know the prison complex. You know, I was part of that.
Yeah.
And in some ways, you know, I don't resent anybody. Mm-hmm. Anything, you know, because I always look at my life. Like I said, I got fired. it's like being promoted. And so going to jail, I went from really being a has-been actor, comedian, to an activist that CNN would call me up. You know, I had all sorts of people calling me, you know, I was a regular almost on Fox News, because I was so anti Bill O'Reilly and that their ratings would go through the roof. Yeah. I think that's what got me busted, because before I got busted, I would go on a lot of right wing talk shows and piss everybody off, but increase their viewership. Yeah. And I think that's what I got their attention, you know, because I would go on the radio show and I would out everybody as potheads,
yeah,
and whether they were or not, you know, I would just I'd be like Fox News, I'd lie, you know. He'd say, you know, isn't weed bad for you? Yeah, well, I smoked with Danny Sullivan, you know, the race car driver. Yeah, him and I, oh, we get high all the time. Well, it was a lie, but I knew Danny Sullivan anyway, you know, and I don't know whether he smoked pot or not, but it would light up the airwaves, you know. Danny Sullivan's a friend of mine, he never smoked pot. It's like, you know, this guy doesn't know what he's doing, he's full of shit, you know. They all went nuts. Well, I think the Bush family, George Bush, when he was president, I think they got wind, or Ashcroft, one of them got wind of it. And anyway, they put a hit on him. Hit a federal hit on me, and so and I had friends in the business that knew about it, but they never told me. Had they told me, I could have got out of the bong business, and but then I wouldn't have done what I did, you know. Yeah. So,
and what would poor Mary Beth Buchanan have done then? She wouldn't have been able to climb up the career ladder as she did, you know, using your good name.
Yeah, she fell off the career ladder.
Has she?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, she lost her job as an attorney, mm-hmm. you know. I think it was because of the press that she got with me. And then she tried to run for some seat as a Republican. And so the Democrats called me in, flew me in to Pennsylvania just to be there, just to show everybody that, Mary Beth Buchanan put Tommy Chong in jail for 9 months for selling bongs.
Yeah, and I got her some hash.
and when they asked her about that, do you regret what you've done with Tommy Chong? And she said, I wish I'd given him more time.
Double Chong. Digging a deeper hole.
And that's the end of her career. Bye-bye. Mary Beth. Bye-bye.
Good riddance to a bad thing anyway. No, it's unfortunate people like that out there. You know, they're just thinking about themselves climbing a career ladder and not thinking about the person affected by their actions. Like taking away 9 months of your life for selling bongs. Surely there's better. Like at a time when you think about it, 9/11 wasn't only 2 years before that with September 11th. The US had a lot going on in terms of their internal national security. Surely there was bigger threats to the nation than Tommy.
You would think, well, you know, when they sentenced me,
mm-hmm.
when they sentenced me on 9/11.
That's right, yeah, on the 2 year
anniversary. And then they tried to make a big deal of it. They had me in the largest courtroom in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
For no reason, because no one showed up. One guy showed up with a sign, a cardboard sign said, free marijuana. One guy.
Jeez.
And there was nobody else because I wasn't part of any organization. You know, wasn't a, legalized nothing. No. It was bongs. It was water pipes.
No,
and when they raided my house, they also raided my my son's factory, and all they did was go in there and smash the bongs.
That was
it. With crowbars. They took them and broke Jeez. All the bongs, like vandals, like drunk fools,
Yeah.
What did that prove? And then they were lying and they were saying that the money, we made billions of dollars from selling bongs, and that the money was going to support terrorism. It was sick. And the thing is, they knew all these things were lies.
Yeah.
And so what it was a war machine. Mm-hmm. The people that, the arms people and the oil people that wanted the war, because when you got a war going on, man, oil prices go through the roof, and the guns, you got to sell them tanks and all that crap, What were we spending? There's like a couple of million dollars a day for these wars that went on for 20 years.
Jeez. Yeah, the operation for you was $12 million alone.
Yeah.
2,000 actors involved in it.
For had they called me on the phone, I would have come in.
Saved a lot of money.
They would have saved a lot of money. We weren't trying. In fact, they actually helped the business. They put an undercover agent in there to find out our finances. Well, he found out that we were operating at a deficit. We were losing money. And part of the reason we're losing money is because we never had a proper business plan. And so while the undercover guy was there, he kind of gave us a proper business plan. He showed us how to operate the business properly. and then we went out of business. So it was, but oh yeah.
More thirsty.
Yeah. It really helped though. My son went back to school. And, he went back and he tried to get a law degree, but then he just couldn't deal with all the reading, all that crap, and he's an artist. He's a really good artist.
Yeah.
But, and now, thanks to my notoriety, we're on the verge of becoming a $100 million business, you know.
That's right, yeah. Like, what's it like now when you think about it? You were in prison for 9 months, and right now the cannabis is an essential business in certain states where it's legal.
Yeah, isn't that something? It's essential.
Lunacy.
All the bars are closed.
Yeah, the bars
are closed. And the pot shops are wide open. Pot shops are wide open. It's okay. It's my daughter.
Apologies.
But she knows that I'm on the thing. Yeah, isn't that funny?
Yeah. How many kids do you have, Tommy, if I can ask?
I've got five of my, well, of my,
yeah,
you know, my wife and I have three, my first wife and I have two, and then I have four or five grandkids, and then I've got two great grandkids. So I got a nice family. My son Paris married a Muslim from Jakarta, and so we got a
They've Indonesian bloodline even more.
Yeah, we got an Indonesian family and a granddaughter, Kira, and another granddaughter, Kelly, and another granddaughter, Camille, and I got Gus is my grandson, a surfer. He's a little surfer in Canada, and Jack is a filmmaker in Toronto. He's a grandson, and Morgan is, I guess he's a finance guy. He went to university, got a degree, and he's in financing. And he has two children with a Chinese lady. And so I've got, a nice Technicolor family. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're all great. They're all beautiful.
Nice. And I see you've also got a nice growing range of products at Tommy Chong's products as well. Can I ask, what's your favorite product on your range?
Probably our single joints. What do you call it? Pre-rolls.
Pre-rolls.
The pre-rolls. Let's see if I got one here. Yeah, I got crap all over the place, man. I am such a. I got him here. This isn't my company, but this is what we. This is our favorite product, you know, the pre-rolls. They're nice. We're doing well with them, but we're trying to get our business up so we can get into the dispensaries all over the world.
Yeah,
you know, that's my goal is I want to get the whole world stoned.
Nice. Did you ever think when you started off with Cheech and Chong that you would have been owning your own cannabis brand one day?
Listen, I had trouble coming to the grips that I own a car. every time I get in my car, I go, look at this, it's me, it's mine. You know, I spent so much of my life with the cheapest cars you could buy. You know, one time you could buy a car for $100 and you didn't resell it, you just junked it or you parked it and walked away, you know. Back in the day, you know, when everything was in the 50s,
yeah,
in the 50s, in the 60s, the 60s, you could buy a lot of cheap, really cheap cars. $100, that was usually what we did. And then, I worked my way up until, you know, I bought my first brand new car was a Citroen Maserati.
Ooh. Sounds nice.
And I had it in Mexico one time, and I picked up the kid hitchhiking, and the kid, hey, thanks for the ride, man. He says, but you know, your car sure is ugly.
Very thankful passenger.
But it's so honest. It's so honest Mexican.
You gotta love that. Gotta love honesty. Can I ask you, Tommy?
Sure.
To explain something, when you got out of prison, you had to go through a probation period, and you had to register as a narcotic offender, is it?
Yeah, a drug offender.
A drug offender. Yeah. So your probation period, did you have to abstain from consumption during that period?
I had to abstain pre-trial probation.
Oh, wow.
I got tested. The minute I got nailed by the cops, I quit smoking. And I never smoked again until I got off probation. So it was about 3 years. Three years without. Because I knew, you know, I've known the game for all my life, you know. And the thing is, these drug tests and all that, they're traps.
Yeah.
You know, once they get you in there, they give you incentive to break the law, mm-hmm. you know. And if you break the law, then they add more time on your sentence. They don't have to go to court. Yeah. They don't have to do anything. You broke a rule, you get another year. You get, you know, that's why they'll give you a suspended sentence. So that it's always hanging over your ear, always hanging over you if you step out of bounds. Well, I knew that, you know. My family, we used to take in people that just got out of prison.
Yeah.
And if you want an education on the law, talk to ex-prisoners, because mm-hmm. they've gone through the whole thing. Yeah. In fact, when I was in Taft, there was a guy, a lawyer that was so-called helping other people, but he was more than just blowing off steam more than anything. But I knew that these traps existed. Mm-hmm. And so when I went in, I got tempted. Right as soon as I walked in the prison, guys were offering me joints, because if they could bust me, they got time off of their sentence. That's yeah. how the prisons worked. You know, it's a snitch place. And so I made a point of not smoking until I was totally in the clear.
Lovely, yeah.
And then I did it, because I just wanted to show everybody that
it can be done.
Weed is not addicting.
Oh, it's not.
You know?
No, definitely.
Guys in prison, they were crying over cigarettes or over anything. One time I got gout, and they gave me medicine, and I took a couple of pills. Boom, gout's gone. But I had a whole mess of pills. Well, the guy across the cubicle from me, he literally begged me for those pills, because he had an addiction. Can you imagine taking other people's medication because it gets you high? I mean, you want to come on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God. Oh, yeah. to be caught in that kind of web, you know. Yeah. No, I was clean. I was clean. I passed every drug test. They even try to fool you. You know, they say, what have you been doing? What do you mean?
Doing salsa.
you know, the test, I don't know. It's kind of proven, you know, you must have been doing something. You know, they try to get you to confess.
Yeah.
And if you confess, well, then they don't have to worry about it. But
you mean they try to give you the impression that you're after failing the test?
Yeah.
Get you to admit that you've done something, even though you've passed it.
Well, they don't tell you you passed. Yeah. You know, they never give you the good news. It's just that, okay, everything, okay, you can go now. And so you go, you know. So you don't know. They're not nice to you at all. They don't try to be nice, you know, or accommodating. It's not like when you go to a doctor, you know. when you're getting a drug test by the feds or by those people, man, they're pretty brutal.
Yeah.
And well, I used to fill, I'd pee the thing till it filled right up to the brim, then hand it to them. Oh,
good man. And can I ask, like, having this first-hand experience now, you're working as an ambassador with the Last Prisoner Project at the moment. The work that they do, I'm very well aware of the work that they're doing. But what's your role as an ambassador with the Last Prisoner Project, and how are you helping them out?
But just by talking to them. And giving them hope, and understanding what they went through, you know. It's pretty tough, you know. You know, the toughest thing about prison, for the most part, is leaving it, you know. You get used to being confined, you know, you get habits, and there's a lot of people. That's why there's a lot of crime, recidivism rate is very high because of that, because there's no future on the outside. See, inside, you got a future. You know what you're going to be doing every day. And you know when you're going to shower, you know when you're going to eat. And then if you've got connections, you got the run of the place, yeah. You know, unless something happens and they lock everybody down. But for the most part, I had the run of the prison, you know. And if I wasn't coming out to a loving family like I was in a career and everything else, I would find a way to stay in there, because everything in prison, you got everything you need. You got time to mm-hmm. yourself. You see, that's most important. And when you look at people, you know, when they let them out of prison, see, back in the day in Canada, they started having, they have a John Hopkins organization, and that was to help people, you know, give them a suit, a clothes, help them find a job, get them a place to stay. I don't think they have that now anymore. And they sure don't have it in the States. Like in New York, when they let people out, they'll let them out in the middle of the night, in the morning, and they'll take them down to the Skid Row area and just dump them there. And it's like, it's like catch and release, you know, yeah. with the rats. You know, you catch a rat and you take them out in the country and let the cage out, let them go. And that's the way they handle it. For the most part, that's the way they handle the prisoners. Mm-hmm. And so they have halfway houses here. And I was in a halfway house. And a halfway house is full of con men, you know, full of guys that they got me right away. They got me right away. I'm on my bunk, you know, it's a like a community bunk place where there's about 10 guys in the same area, you know, and you got a bunk, and I was up in my bunk, and I heard the guy on the phone, and he's lamenting that, you know, well, I don't know, he doesn't have any money, and he doesn't know how he's going to do this. He's got a lot of things to pay and all that. And I heard him. And then I realized later that he wanted me to hear him. Because it was a setup for me to go, hey, man, I'll help you. You know, because, you know, I wasn't hurting financially. And because I had friends, you know, Gold's Gym, we were talking about weightlifting.
Yeah.
Well, when I was in the halfway house, I needed a job so I could get out during the day. Mm-hmm. If you have a job, you get out during the day. Now you had to have your earnings to the halfway house, you know.
Yeah.
And then you had to check in all the time to make sure you're really at the job you're supposed to be at. Well, of course, I wasn't really at the job I was supposed to be at. I could have been. You know, and for the most part, I did. I liked the gym anyway. And I tried to work. Joe Gold wouldn't let me. I tried because I got used to it, sweeping and picking up trash, you know. And yeah. So my first day out at the gym, I got a broom. I'm out there sweeping. And Joe Gold calls me in. Oh, Christ's sake, what are you doing? You're not working. Go work out. You want to work? Go work on some weights. You know, it was embarrassing for him for to have prison help, you know. But yeah, the halfway house, it's crazy. It's another thing, you
so
know.
You have to stay there as part of your probation period, is it?
Yes, for yeah. a month. For a month.
Just 1 month.
And then I got out July 4th. It was the July 4th that I did a whole month. And then I was July 4th, I was free, you know, free of the thing. And I had a, where I leased my car from, you know, he was an old buddy of mine. So I didn't want to have a nice new car, you know, waiting for me, you know, yeah. You know, because I'd park it on the street and go in the halfway house, and then do the night and then get up the next day and go get in my car. So he gave me an old beat up Cadillac, you know, which suited the neighborhood. And so I had a car. Yeah.
You need to.
It was, I got to tell you, man, it was an experience that I treasure. It was not, it was all new to me because I had evolved to the point, especially spiritually, you know, because that's one of the things I'd been working on before I went in. And then when I went in, I went full spiritual, you know, into the I Ching, into all the metaphysical readings and that. And then I joined the Sweat Lodge Society in prison. And that was all about spirituality. And so I just, and then I continued when I got out, you know, just being very, very spiritual.
And when I was in a prison, I asked the prison officer for a book. Guess what he gave me? Mein Kampf. Adolf Hitler.
Mein Kampf. He gave you Mein Kampf.
He gave me Mein Kampf. There you go. What the hell? What you oh, my God. It was enough.
Did you read it? Did you read it?
I read a couple of chapters. Yeah, I got a couple of chapters out of it. Yeah. It was okay. It wasn't a bad read.
Hey, Hitler was a real bad guy, but he was an artist.
Yeah.
He had an artist soul, for sure. For sure. He was a little twisted, but actually the guys he hired were more twisted than he was, I think, you know, but he was an artist and I have never read his book, but yeah, I will one period of time, you know. Did you see, I was just watching CNN where the Nazi thing in Germany sprung up again, you know.
Yeah, the 100-year-old man getting criminalized for the Nazi crimes.
Yeah.
Mad.
Yeah, the Nazi thing, and they're, you know, defacing the Holocaust museums and all that stuff. But, it's ignorance that will always be with us.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason. There's a reason for these guys, and we're the reason. You know, if it wasn't for them, there wouldn't be us.
Yeah.
You know, if it wasn't for those idiots, we wouldn't be talking about going to jail and helping others and everything else. And so there is as necessary to our being as anybody else. Mm-hmm. The opposites. So of course, yeah, there's Nazis. There always will be on this plane of existence because you can't have one without the other.
Definitely,
you know, you need left in order to have right. You need up in order to have down. You need good in order to have bad, or you need bad in order to have good. That's because if there was no bad, there would be no good.
that's very true. But yeah,
and that's where we are. That's where we are. If it wasn't for idiots, you and I wouldn't be even talking.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why you have to make mistakes to learn from them. That's pretty much it, isn't it? Really, like we learn from the mistakes we make as a society, and we improve, we grow from there. We hopefully won't have any more Hitlers in the future.
But no, there will be. There will be. There will be all of that in the future. It's only bigger. Well, look at Trump. Trump is a good example of what happens if you don't believe the good guy. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think that the good guy is lying and then you put all your marbles with the bad guy, here you go.
Yeah.
Now you got a president that seriously doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground.
Can I ask you a favor, actually, of you, Tommy, as I have you here? The Irish government we have an opportunity here in Ireland very soon. There's going to be a bill before the Irish government to legalize and regulate cannabis, put forward by Gene O'Kenny, a TD here in Ireland. But we're trying to raise awareness as to the benefits that this will bring by ending this prohibition of cannabis. By getting Alicia home. Alicia Maher is a lady from Cork here, and she had to move from her home to Spain And she's stuck in Spain now because she gets access to cannabis in Spain, and she would be a criminal for it here. So maybe if I could ask you, could you ask the Irish government to support Jean O'Kenny's bill to legalize and regulate cannabis? And I might be able to get a soundbite, and we might be able to get an old viral clip out of this or something.
Okay, so what do you want me to say?
Just to the Irish government, to do the right thing and to enact or to support Jean O'Kenny's bill to legalize and regulate cannabis.
Jean O'Kenny.
Yeah, that's the man.
Okay. Hey, man, this is Tommy Chong, and this is a message for the Irish government. Now, please, gentlemen, or ladies, if there's ladies in the government, do your duty. Please support the bill to legalize Jean O'Kenny's attempt to get her marijuana so she can be healthy, okay? That's all I'm asking. You know, marijuana is a medicine. It's a proven medicine. It works. It helps people with cancer, people with all sorts of ailments, MS. It's proven. So Irish government, please do the right thing. Support the bill to help legalize marijuana.
Thanks very much, Gino, Tommy, for that. I really appreciate it. I've engaged in a couple of campaigns here myself in Ireland. I've brought some cannabis plants into the local cop stations here, and I handed them in civil disobedience. I brought in joints. I brought in cannabis flower itself. Every month this year, I've engaged in at least one civil disobedience protest, and I'm going to continue right up until the end of the year. Some months I've engaged in more than one. I've planted cannabis in the city hall here in Cork City, and I've also brought a cannabis plant to the office of our Prime Minister here in Cork City too, all in support of Alicia Maher. Actually, was the name of the girl. Jean O'Kenny is the politician, but Alicia Maher is the lady that we're supporting there, stuck in Alicante. But I carried out all of those actions. I'm going to be probably going to prison maybe myself if this bill doesn't go get passed. But it's a small price to pay, because
small price.
It is.
That's a small price to pay. You're definitely on the right track. And listen, you're where I was a few years ago, and look where we are now. Mm-hmm. And so you got a great future to ahead of you. And I guess the Irish, you know, it takes them a little time to come around, you know, but eventually it will. You're doing the right thing, and good luck, and keep up the good work.
Thanks very much, Tommy, and thanks again for taking the time out of your day to come and talk with me here. I really do appreciate it, and I'm honored to have you, honestly. Thanks.
Let's stay in touch. I want to hear the rest of the story, okay? I want to hear if Gino responds. And if he does, then let's keep that thing going, okay?
We will indeed. Thanks very much again, Tommy. And we will definitely be in touch. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.
You too. Ciao.
Ciao.